Good evening. It is Thursday, June 4th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C. And you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, after 10 very long and troublesome days in the United States, a private memorial service was held today in Minneapolis for Mr. George Floyd. He died while in police custody. Additional services are planned in North Carolina and Houston over the coming days. In the midst of all of this, we must also remember the African-American female medical worker Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. There are so many others, but those are two of the most recent. Interesting, Scott Hagan, president of North Central University, announced a George Floyd Memorial Scholarship during the services today and challenged every university in the country to do the same. There's a lot going on here today, and for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a political analyst and host of the podcast Public Agenda, Ray Baker. Ray, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, thank you for having me.
Two other interesting things that transpired today. One, the U.S. Senate Democrats gathered this morning for a moment of silence that lasted 8 minutes and 48 seconds, the amount of time former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin held his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck before he died on May 25th. And also today, Governor Ralph Northam, Democrat, governor of Virginia, announced that he will remove the towering statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from its site on Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia, and put it into storage, and that he's going to have that done as soon as possible. Your thoughts on where we are with all of this protest and all of this hand-wringing that we find ourselves being subjected to?
Dr. Leon, I think that America responds to what it thinks will threaten its money. And right now, the temperature, metaphorically, and as we head into summer, perhaps literally, is heating up on so many folks that folks are committed to this idea of not jeopardizing their money. And by jeopardizing their money, they don't want to seem on the wrong side of righteousness. The incident that we saw in Minneapolis was a bit too literal for too many people to turn their backs on. And more pointedly, too many of us are sitting at home. It's the same reason why viral videos and TikTok challenges can take off the way they are. It's because we're sitting at home, so we have nothing to do but to stew in our understanding of mistreatment and injustice. So the larger community, the commerce community by and large, are taking note of this, and they don't want to seem as though they stand on the side of racists. And so we hear these statements and these echoes and calls of critiques of systematic racism so often that it makes us forget how some of our companies, our institutions participate in the systems that they are decrying when they talk about systematic racism.
It's interesting that you make that point, because as I have watched the tremendous turnout for these rallies all across the country, and what I'm saying is in no way, shape, or form to minimize them or condemn them. Not only do I appreciate them, they need to be even bigger than they are. But as I look at them, particularly as I look at the racial dynamic of them and the number of white Americans that have turned out in incredible numbers, I am forced to ask myself, how many of these people would be there if they weren't home due to being laid off from COVID-19? How many of these students would be in these protests if they were still taking final exams in college, or if they were still going to class in high school? Maybe it's the cynic in me, but that's a question that I've asked myself as I have, again, looked at the tremendous turnout that you see all across this country supporting protests of this nature.
I agree with you. I think that it's the perfect storm that has brought the folks into the street in the way that it has. And while I respect and understand your and other folks' cynicism as to who would be here and who would not, if we live in the moment of who is here, one of the things that I've responded to and been curious about seeing is that police are responding to protests about police brutality with police brutality. And one of the things that I think is also we're seeing play out is that white Americans, by and large, are now being randomly attacked. White Americans are being unreasonably tear gassed. White Americans and mainstream journalists are being shot at with rubber bullets and pellets. And my curiosity is...
And being arrested right on our television screens as they're covering these events.
Yeah, correct. And once we see this, once we see the idea that policing doesn't have to be this aggressive terrorist state, yet it is, right? When folks go back to air quote normal, will they remember the police treated them like that? So the next time that we have Tamir Rice, the next time we have, we call the name of Melissa Williams, the next time we say Breonna Taylor's name, the next time there's a Dan Roy Henry, will folks go, no, I remember how police even treated white people? Or will we say, well, you know, what was that person doing? You didn't see what happened before the video started.
Now, we're also seeing, not only are we seeing incredibly aggressive police, and we've got the president talking about invoking the Insurgency Act of 1807, we see police taking off their helmets and kneeling with protesters. We see police, I saw something today on the television, police dancing with protesters. We've got the police chief from New York taking a knee with protesters and saying, I don't have a problem with your protests, and just don't tear my city up. And I'm, you know, I'll support your protests, just don't tear up my city. So we have seen the other side of this with police officers and sheriffs kneeling and praying with protesters as well.
We had a police chief, I believe, in Genesee County, Michigan.
Yes.
If you forgive me for those Michigan folks who may know I'm pronouncing that wrong.
And that was the sheriff.
The sheriff, yep. And one of the things that he said, though, that popped to a lot of people, not just myself, I'm sure, was, I don't want this to be a protest. I want this to be a parade. To which I responded, no, sir, you don't have to bash my head in. You don't even have to march or kneel with me. But I need you to understand this is a protest. And one of the things that I appreciate the police who seem to acknowledge that there's righteous indignation in the street. So if that's what the kneeling or dancing or behavior is to communicate, that's fine. But does that change the material outcome of the way those officers in a given jurisdiction respond to citizens and particularly Black citizens? If it doesn't, then it's all very hollow and empty.
Reverend Sharpton, who eulogized Mr. Floyd today, he said, George Floyd did not die from common medical conditions. He died from a common American system malfunction. And I understand Reverend Sharpton's point, but I still don't think, and I understand his delivery and his context and how he makes his points, but I don't think that was still a strong enough point. This is much deeper than a system malfunction. This is how the system didn't malfunction. The system is operating as the system was designed to operate. And I don't base this on my opinion. We can read the Constitution with the Three-Fifths Compromise and the Fugitive Slave Clause. We can read the Supreme Court decision in a number of Plessy v. Ferguson in a number of cases. That this is how the system was designed to function. It is not a system malfunction.
Dr. Leon, if the system malfunctioned for anyone, it's for Officer Siobhan, who's looking around going, so why am I getting arrested? And that's where the malfunction would be.
Because I didn't get that memo.
He wholly believes, I'm assuming Mr. Siobhan, and now the three other officers who stood and watched, they wholly believe, well, this is the way it goes, right? Because we've had so much evidence whether we're talking about Betty Shelby, who shot and killed Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who then became a police officer trainer, right? So when people talk about the suggestions to police reform is to increase police training, my curiosity becomes, so who's training these folks, right? Because we already have the evidence of who the trainers can become. Whether we're talking about the officer, Timothy, I believe his name's Lowfield, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing it, who shot and killed Tamir Rice before he got out of the car, who had already moved from multiple police departments because of complaints about the way that he had brutalized the citizens that he was there to serve. So the person who's probably looking around at the malfunction would be the four officers in Minneapolis who are now behind bars, curious as to why they are there this time. And so the malfunction that Reverend Sharpton is alluding to goes back to me about this idea of systems. And we heard President Obama, who's been more vocal of late because the nation just seems to have that void of leadership, talking about an acknowledgement of systemic racism. And my curiosity, and perhaps this is the cynicism that you alluded to earlier, but this may be my own cynicism, if we acknowledge a system is flawed, and we call the president of the United States the leader of the free world, which ostensibly would mean that person is in charge of the system. If that person can't fix the systems, then what good does it do us to diagnose a problem as systemic? So many people want to identify systems, but the way that we're identifying the critique of systemic racism has now absolved the responsibility of the individuals who willingly participate in that system because they find value or see that system to be noble at the core, where time and time again, it's evident that if the system is flawed, then we think individual actors to be superlative. Those actors must go in and change that system, but they don't. They go in and participate in that system, perpetuate that system, and then when they leave out of that system, they have the audacity, Dr. Leon, to look around and go, well, I can't believe that systemic racism did that. No, systemic racism didn't kill George Floyd. Derek Chauvin's knee did. And we need to hold Derek Chauvin, Betty Shelby, and every other officer who is killing citizens, black, white, and otherwise, but we know statistics tell us that it's black folks. Hold them individually accountable, and if you aren't willing to change the system, then don't be a part of the system.
There's a hearing today. It was held in the case of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. Now it's come out. He was hit with a truck before he died, and his killer allegedly used a racial slur. This is according now to investigators. William Bryan told investigators he heard Travis McMichael use a racial epithet after fatally shooting Ahmaud Arbery in Glenn County, according to the Georgia Bureau of Investigations. Bryan told police McMichael said effing N-word after three blasts from McMichael's shotgun left Arbery dead in February. And then, of course, we know that there's body camera footage that also showed a Confederate flag sticker on the toolbox of McMichael's truck. So now we have, as we are going through remembering George Floyd, we are now going through the hearings in the Ahmaud Arbery case in Georgia.
We are. And one of the things that I think this will finally do is give teeth to civil rights, to Justice Department civil rights charges that we have not seen on this level since, if I'm not mistaken, Dylann Roof. I know that Michael Slagle, who shot and killed Walter Scott, faced federal charges as well, but I'm not certain if those were hate crimes. But now we have the evidence that we need to be hate crimes. And my only hope is that many white Americans don't walk away from this and look at Mr. McMichael and his son as, quote, the bad apples, as some sort of aberration to the traditional or standard way of American existence. And finally, we can begin to penetrate and investigate the symbolism of this Confederate flag sticker, because we are smart enough to know that the line about heritage, not hate, is BS. And these times that we see that type of symbolism, it is signaling to, whether consciously or unconsciously, others who may have aggressive and racist views about black folks that black folks aren't welcome here, and I remember and yearn for the days when black folks were enslaved, and that's what that sticker means. And if we walk away from this experience learning or thinking or believing anything else, we are fools,
the same way we were fools when we walked away from seeing what Dylann Roof did and isolating him as some sort of single lone wolf who was capable of such a heinous act.
You know, it's very interesting that you put it in that context, because I don't know if you had a chance to watch the news conference from Virginia today, from Richmond, Virginia, as Governor Northam announced that he was removing the statue of Robert E. Lee. He had Robert E. Lee's, I guess that was his great, great, great nephew, Robert W. Lee, I think, and he's a pastor. And one of the things that he said, I have to tell you something about my uncle. He said he was a very complex man, and he was a man of his time. But the one thing that cannot be overlooked is that he led a rebellion against the United States to support slavery. And that can never be excused. So it's time for the monument to come down. I just found it very interesting. The case that they laid out, a number of the people who spoke today at this press conference announcing that these Confederate statue, the statue honoring Robert E. Lee, was going to come down from Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia, and put into storage. So a lot of what they talked about, the lost cause, and that was a lost effort. It was very interesting listening, particularly coming from Virginia, listening to this discussion about why those Confederate symbols must come down.
You know, Doc, there are states in our union that were not even a part of the United States or the Confederate States of America who have Confederate statues. There are states in our union, Michigan comes to mind specifically, that were that sent some of the most valiant soldiers to participate in Civil War, who have Confederate statues. So that tells me that this idea of mythmaking, this lost cause, this war between brothers, is something that was very deliberate, very intentional, and it's something that such groups as the United Daughters of the Confederacy wanted us to think about their ancestors in glowing and loving terms. The United States begrudgingly went to war over the question of domestic slave trade. The United States begrudgingly did that. And that is why folks can be so forgiving and make such amends to people who we otherwise, and in other contexts about war against the United States, we would think it unreasonable and unfathomable to build statues to them. And so that shows you that whiteness in the United States, and for years, centuries, has transcended all, even the beloved patriotism, which Americans so often cling to.
And as we get out to that point, it's important to realize that in many of these states, many of these statues were not erected after the war. They were erected in the 50s as a symbol. They were erected in the 40s and the 50s as a very clear message that racism, white supremacy was still dominant, prevalent, and controlling the narrative, which is why I've been saying, what we see with the murder of Mr. Floyd, what we see with the murder of Breonna Taylor and so many others, I say the North won the war, but the South won the argument.
Yes, sir.
And what I mean by that is, the North did win the Civil War, but when you look at the prevalence of racism, white supremacy in this country, and how deeply woven into the very fabric of America it is, the Southern argument carried the day.
Real quick, Dr. Leon, I know you got to get out of here, but 2 points about this. That's one reason why so many white Americans can make the argument that the Civil War wasn't actually about slavery, because white supremacy ruled the day, just as you alluded to. So it's the belief that among particularly those Southern sympathizers who think that the Civil War was a question of states' rights and everything else, because they go, well, look at the way that the white supremacy continued to live on thereafter, it couldn't have been a question about slavery. But to further your point about the erection of these statues, particularly in the late 1940s and 50s, what we had contextually, this is for your listeners, what we had contextually are that black soldiers who fought valiantly, and nobly in World War II on multiple theaters, come back home and inspired by such civil rights organizations for the Double V campaign, victory at home and victory abroad. I've shown myself and proved myself worthy of humanity, worthy of equal rights, and now I will come home after defeating Hitler and defeat the Hitler at home against me. And white Americans said, not so fast. Let us remind you, those who we think to be so important, we will erect statues of them and remind you that those folks once enslaved your people.
And that's also what led us to the bloody summer of 1919. And it's also important to remember that the Civil War was about the abolition of slavery. It was not about the equality of the African in America. Those two things, that's why I say the North won the war and the South won the argument. Ray Baker, thank you, man. Really, really appreciate it. Great analysis. As always, appreciate your time. Look forward to having you back.
Yes, sir. Stay safe, Dr. Leon. Take care of you.
You too. You too. Thank you. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. We are watching on our TV screens and hearing on the radio what authoritarianism really looks and sounds like. As President Donald Trump faces growing criticism from veterans and some ex-military leaders, including his former Defense Secretary General Jim Mattis, for deploying U.S. troops against peaceful protesters, busloads of soldiers arrived in the nation's capital yesterday in what critics warned is part of the White House's effort to intimidate and squash nationwide demonstrations against the police killing of George Floyd. How does all of this play into the militarization of America? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's the co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace and former VP nominee for the Green Party, Ajamu Baraka. As always, Ajamu, welcome back.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
So more than 10 tour buses filled with troops pulled up in Washington yesterday afternoon after Pentagon Chief Mark Esper, who just hours earlier balked at Trump's threat to use active duty forces to confront protesters, reversed his order, sending soldiers home from the Capital Region following a meeting at the White House. What are we seeing going on here now?
Well, in terms of policy coming from the White House or consistent positions, there seems to be none. That there's disarray in terms of how they should be attempting to frame the situation how they should react to it. So, yeah, clearly there are some forces that want to see a crackdown. They're tired of these images being circulated around the world, and they want to, they've been advising Trump that he needs to demonstrate some resolve and bring in sufficient forces to clamp down. On the other hand, there seem to be some that say, let's try to play it out, keep, people on the street, but make sure that they are so-called peaceful and show our tolerance. So it's clearly they're going back and forth. But it seems that those who want to see a more aggressive stance seem to be winning out for at least for now.
Is there a signal being sent to you as more of the generals are now coming out against the actions by the president? And because we know that there are, to your point, there are various factions within an administration. We've got the military. We've got the military side. We have the CIA and that. I'm drawing a blank on that word I'm looking for. Anyway, the CIA and the NSA and that whole apparatus. And so when the generals start to turn on the commander in chief, is that sending a signal to you?
Well, not really, Dr. Leon. I try to put this stuff in perspective. A comment came from Mike Milligan who was the Joint Chiefs of Staff under head of Joint Chiefs of Staff under Barack Obama, and then you had the comment from who I consider to be a war criminal, Jim Mad Dog Mathis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really put a whole lot of stock in these generals, and I don't see this being. I haven't seen any additional comments, so I don't see this as being okay. kind of a tidal wave of military folks being opposed to the to President Trump.
We're also seeing a dangerous new factor being introduced to this equation: unidentified law enforcement officers. They were really prevalent here in Washington, D.C. There were a number of heavily armed law enforcement folks who, for the most part, you couldn't really tell where they were coming from, what they represented, what their affiliation was, who they were personally. None of that was really discernible. Now, some appeared to be with the Bureau of Prisons, but to a great degree, they were just clad in black, helmets, weaponry, boots, and you didn't know who they represented.
Maybe they were Russians. You remember in Ukraine when they claimed everybody who showed up with some kind of uniform was a Russian, you know.
Susan Rice is now blaming the violence in the protests. Oh, that's right out of the Russian playbook. So maybe
we really shouldn't be laughing, but it's so incredibly ridiculous, you know.
Right. You have to laugh.
Who knows? You have to laugh it. I mean, who knows who these forces are?
No, but my real question is not knowing. It's the fact that we don't know. And that that seems to be adding another. For all we know, they could be Blackwater operatives and, you know, mercenaries. When the state imposes law enforcement on people, those people would expect to at least know who those individuals or what entity those individuals represent.
Now, I hear you. I think you're absolutely right. That is a very ominous sort of turn, because if you can't identify them, then you can't really hold them accountable. So you're right. It could be mercenaries. It could be some other kind of a paramilitary force that we don't know of, and can't attach to any structure where we could hold them accountable to whatever actions they may involve themselves in. So yeah, this is another serious example of the kind of militarism that we're seeing from this administration. And it's something that we definitely need to be concerned with. No question about that.
I was talking to some folks earlier who were drawing connections between the violence that the United States is bringing to Venezuela, the violence that the United States is bringing to Bolivia and Yemen, and the violence that we are now seeing play itself out here on the shores of the United States, that you can't separate what's happening domestically with what the United States is engaged in terms of foreign policy.
Well, you really can't. I mean, and it's all connected to a certain kind of mindset. And, you know, there is a certain degree of violence that we are seeing in the U.S. But what we can disconnect is the notion that the level of extreme violence that the U.S. state has been involved in various parts of the world can in any way be compared to what seems like, you know, something that pales in comparison. With a few people getting pushed and hit upside the head and all of that in the U.S. I mean, so we have not seen the full potential of what violence can look like in the U.S. Some of us who are old enough remember and went through repression in the 1960s, where they clamped down a whole community, did house-to-house searches, where when the National Guard got called in, and they put up blockades or roadblocks, and people ended up starting to be murdered at those roadblocks. We have seen the hand of repression. What we've seen thus far, in my opinion, is nothing but sort of an audition.
What we've seen is an audition. There's another interesting element to this. Staff members at the New York Times are publicly rebuking their newspaper for publishing this opinion piece by Senator Tom Cotton, where he's calling for military intervention into American cities that are protesting over George Floyd's death. There are, I would say, a number of layers to staff members and the rebuking their own newspaper, and that newspaper being the New York Times.
It is very interesting, but you know, it's interesting on so many different levels, because you know, it's not like the New York Times has not engaged in opening up its pages to those kinds of perspectives. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a few months ago, I mean, they were the ones that are helping to create the environment to force people back into the workplace. Everybody's looking at Trump, but there were editorials in the New York Times that say, hey, it's basically time to go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess people forget also, too, Dr. Leon, that Lyndon Baines Johnson, you know, brought in the 82nd Airborne into Washington, D.C. after the uprisings, after they murdered Dr. King. This is not mm-hmm. something that's really that unusual. So, yeah, we know that the whole thing is about Trump and Trump being some aberration. But for those of us who are students of history, I just don't get too excited about this stuff.
And Cotton mentioned this in his op-ed, defending the president's invocation of the Insurrection Act of 1807, claiming that rioters have plunged many American cities into anarchy. And when in fact, it was Donald Trump's own Attorney General William Barr who came into Lafayette Park on Monday and directed the whoever was in control of that action to be sure that the park was cleared by 6:30 Monday evening, inciting the mayhem that prior to that was a peaceful protest.
Well, sure, yeah. And that was really something that, again, demonstrated the kind of heavy-handed tactics that the state can engage in and did engage in that case to just prove a point that Trump wanted to demonstrate that he was not hiding out in the basement. So he had to do his tough guy act, which meant they had to clear the space for him. This is all theater. I mean, you know, it's dangerous and all of that. But, you know, what does it really mean in the end? I mean, this notion that this is representing something that's fundamentally different, again, it just doesn't seem to be historically correct. And with the demonstrations now sort of beginning to dissipate and the lack of any kind of real political direction for what people are marching for today, you know, I think that the state is angling or depending on that these things are going to begin to kind of peter out after a while, unless they do a France and pivot to another level of politics where the target really is the state. And the neoliberal system, then we will see a massive violent reaction from the state, and it will get the full support of the entire ruling class. So this idea, this is like Trump, and Trump is doing something unusual. I just have to continue to push back on this, because when the state feels threatened by a real opposition, we saw under Barack Obama how quickly they snuffed out the Occupy movement. This is about the state and about the system, not about any one individual.
You mentioned protests dissipating, and that's something that I've been asking for a while. What is this really all about? I asked that in no way, shape, or form, giving short shrift to people's sentiments about the murder of Mr. Floyd or about Ahmaud Arbery or about Miss Taylor. But I have not really heard an articulated agenda that people can pick up and advance once the protesters or the protests dissipate. You got a lot of angry people in the street, and they're angry and they're rightfully angry, and they're protesting as they should. But what do we do tomorrow? What's the agenda? What's the battle plan? And I'm not hearing that.
Well, I think you're right. And like you said, I mean, it's always good to see resistance. And, you know, from the very beginning, it was a little incoherent because the demand was something called justice for George Floyd. Now, we took the position that justice for colonized people is really impossible, even if someone is prosecuted and even convicted, because it's George Floyd today and it's somebody else tomorrow. I mean, the system continues. But, you know, right now there's no coherency in terms of where people need to be going politically. The people are angry, but they angry. I mean, the George Floyd thing was the trigger. They angry because of everything that's happening around them. The hundreds of African-Americans who are dying every day from COVID-19. The fact that millions of people are unemployed. Young people, young white kids out there marching because they don't see any future for themselves. All of this stuff, though, has not galvanized into a political line, a political analysis, and a set of demands. But it could. That's what I meant when I said it could turn, it looks like what happened in France. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a possibility. And if that happens, then the state really will have something on their hands.
So real quick, we've got just about a minute left. That doesn't happen organically, that comes from leadership. So where's the leadership?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it what happened in France ended up kind of happening organically. It came out of the struggles of folks of the yellow vests in the streets, and they gradually began to narrow down their politics and get some focus to their politics. So that could happen even here. I can see a subtle shift happening as people beginning to move to a clearer understanding that it is the state and the system, as opposed to just looking at the police or a justice for one individual.
Brother Ajamu Baraka, you are, man, always so gracious when we call. We truly, truly appreciate it. We look forward to having you back.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Google faces a $5 billion class action lawsuit in the United States for tracking private internet use. They were sued on Tuesday, accusing the internet company of illegally invading the privacy of millions of users by pervasively tracking their internet use through browsers set in private mode. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a web developer and technologist, Chris Garaffa. Chris, as always, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, great to be back. Thanks for having me.
So the suit is seeking at least $5 billion, accusing Alphabet Inc., the Alphabet Inc. unit, of serendipitously collecting information about what people view online and where they browse, despite their using what Google calls incognito mode. Can you explain that, please?
Absolutely. I want to say first, I mean, I think this lawsuit is absolutely correct. Google is absolutely tracking everything you do online and in many of the apps on your phone. You know, many apps and many websites include what's called Google Analytics or Google Ads. And that's not just saying, oh, you know, this you got this many hits on your website. It's who visited. Now, the website user, the website owner, or the app owner doesn't necessarily get to see who you are, just that you visited and you went from this one page to the next one, and then you purchased something, or you looked at products and didn't purchase them, and then they can coordinate that to have Google send you an email, things like that, right? So Google does this whether you're in incognito mode or what people might call private browsing mode. Different browsers call it different things. So private browsing, incognito mode. And, you know, it's very important for people to understand that using that private browsing in incognito mode doesn't actually protect you from tracking. Google's response to this lawsuit is that they, you know, they have a warning or a message that when you open a new private window, it says your activity might still be visible to websites you visit, your employer or school, and your internet service provider. those things are technically correct, but the average person's understanding of websites you visit, that first line there, is not the same as what actually is happening. If I weren't aware of everything that Google is doing in the background to track us, I would just think that, okay, yeah, this website, I'm on this website, they can see that somebody is visiting their website. I would not think that Google, I might not even know that Google is involved, that they have Google Analytics or ads. I wouldn't think that just by being on a website, Google also has access to what I'm doing on this site. I think this is a great and very important lawsuit. I don't have high hopes for it, unfortunately, but I hope there are more like this.
And the word I struggled with was surreptitiously. I just wanted people to know I can say surreptitiously. So this is the example of if I'm searching for tennis rackets or tennis shoes, and then I go to read a newspaper online, and then all of a sudden, throughout the article that I'm reading, ads for tennis shoes and tennis rackets pop up for weeks. So this is what we're talking about.
Yeah, that is exactly a huge part of what you're talking about. And it's not just about, you know, you being on the web and what pages you visit and what you search for, right? They can track you by other identifiers from your device, from your screen size to the Wi-Fi network that you are on to location. They take thousands and thousands of different signals and combine those to create a profile. And they can do this across devices now. So they can track you from a computer to a phone, for example, and infer that this is the same person browsing.
So what is really the issue here? Is it that Google is tracking me this way? Is it that Google is tracking me this way, even though I say I don't want to be tracked this way? Is it that Google is tracking me this way and not telling me in a manner that I can, as a non-technical person, you know, contrary to you, that so I don't get it? All of the above. What's at the crux of this issue?
The crux of this issue is a combination of everything you have said and more. It is that Google is tracking everything we are doing. And in most instances, we don't think we're interfacing with Google at all, but they have sold and pitched so many services that website operators use, like their analytics, like their ad packages, and like many others that we never see when we're browsing a website, that they are effectively on every page that we go to, whether we know it or not.
How big of a issue is this? How much of an invasion of our privacy is this? How concerned should the average internet user be? And is Google really doing this? Is this a Big Brother thing where Google is now working with the government to track what I'm doing? And to your point about moving it from device to device, tracking my whereabouts on the phone and all of that, is this really Big Brother peering into my life now?
Even if Google weren't working with the government, which we know they are, they partner with the NSA and other law enforcement, this would still be a huge concern that this one giant company has all of this information about us. You know, many people, you know, say in the NBC News, the article in about the lawsuit states, you know, Google has information about everything you search for, every page you have viewed effectively. And that could include health information, very personal, private things that you've wanted to, you know, learn about or explore online. And this company can use it to effectively to make money. When you combine that with their partnership with the police state and the national surveillance state, what we have now is the ability for them to use anything you've ever searched against you. And that has been done in court before.
I've been told that using engines like Siri or DuckDuckGo are ways to circumvent this intrusion into my privacy. Is that true, or is that a different issue? And no matter what you do, and I think you touched on this up front, no matter what you do, you can no longer avoid the long tentacles of Google.
Using a search engine like DuckDuckGo is actually a great idea. That prevents Google from getting a record of what you've searched. But you need to take another step and install what's called an ad blocker on your phone or your computer. I recommend uBlock Origin on computers in any browser, and Firefox Focus on your phone. And that prevents, no matter what page you're on, it prevents all of those tracking scripts from even loading, so that they have, it's much harder and sometimes impossible at a certain level for them to get that information about you. So use a different search engine, but also install these tools.
Okay. And you said earlier, you don't think that this lawsuit is going to be successful. Why not?
Google is effectively Alphabet, Google's parent company, is a $1 trillion company. They have lawyers, they have lobbyists. They are going to fight this. Ultimately, a $5 billion lawsuit is actually nothing for them, but they are going to fight this because of the PR consequences that it's going to have to admit, whether by a judgment or by settling, that they were in the wrong.
And in your opinion, they are very clearly in the wrong.
Oh, they are absolutely in the wrong. But I think in the legal realm, in the realm of the real world and the courts, they're going to, and they've already said, they're going to fight this every step of the way.
Chris Garaffa, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you again.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. You know, in the U.S., we are told they are evil. We are told they are the enemy. But they are leading by example. Cuba in the COVID-19 pandemic. According to Counterpunch, the response of socialist Cuba to the global SARS-CoV-2 pandemic has been outstanding both domestically and for its international contribution. For insight into this, we turn to my next guests. First, she is the co-founder of Code Pink and author of the Jacobin article, We Should Applaud the Cuban Health System and Learn from It, Medea Benjamin. As always, Medea, welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
We're also joined by a Canadian writer and journalist. He's the author of 3 books on Cuban politics. Over the last year, he has been on an international book tour, which took him throughout Canada, United States, the UK, as well as Cuba to promote his latest work. He is Arnold August. Arnold, welcome to The Critical Hour.
It's a pleasure to be with both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Medea. Let me start with you. Code Pink is supporting an effort behind the nomination of Cuba's medical brigade for receiving the Nobel Prize. Talk about that and explain what people can do to back that move.
We were inspired, just like millions of people around the world have been inspired, seeing the Cuban medical brigade. It's actually called the Henry Reeve International Medical Brigade, sending out groups around 25 countries at this point. The first one being very dramatic, going to the most infected part of Italy in Lombardy. And it showed how a small country with very few resources that's able to show what international solidarity looks like. In fact, the known writer and linguist Noam Chomsky said that Cuba is the only country to have shown genuine internationalism during this crisis. And we thought that this merits the Nobel Peace Prize. So we have a campaign that we are just beginning to launch. The official launch will be in 10 days, on the 16th of June. But in the meantime, there is a website already up. It's called Cuba Nobel, as in Nobel Peace Prize, NOBEL.org. And there you can sign. And when you're signing, know that you're in good company. You're with past Nobel Peace laureates like Adolfo Pérez Esquivel, writers like Alice Walker, actors like Danny Glover, filmmakers like Oliver Stone, musicians like Tom Morello, just a wonderful group of now close to 5,000 people that have signed on already, and we would love to have your listeners join us. So once again, that's cubanobel.org.
Arnold, how is it that this small island nation of Cuba, it's been subjected to hundreds of years of colonialism and imperialism since the revolution in 1959, 60 years of criminal United States blockades. How is it that this small island is playing such a key role, not only in COVID-19, but in freedom struggles all around the world?
Yeah, this is really an amazing page in world history. I would like to say that the Counterpunch article that you quote points out various reasons. I would like to concentrate on one main reason, and that is since 1959, the Cubans developed society which is socialist, and in that I would like to emphasize the planned nature of a socialist society. That is, they start from scratch. What do we need in terms of the economy, products, consumer products, other products, culture, sport, health, education, etc.? And everything is very highly centralized. Of course, this is supposed to be a terrible thing. You know, communist country, it's highly centralized and all that. But I could not help to notice, if, for example, in Canada, where everything has gone so bad in the health system, those who are always against centralizing parts of the economy are not now admitting that, well, we should think of centralizing and nationalizing the health system in Canada. We should think of nationalizing the companies that produce masks and other protective gear for health workers and the general population. So I think that is the main feature in terms of the structure, the planning. But I would have to say, you have to go to Cuba, like both of us have done. I don't know if you've been there yet, Wilma, to know firsthand the patriotic and revolutionary spirit of the vast majority of the Cuban people. They have gone, as you just listed off a whole paraphrase of activities by the United States against Cuba, have resisted to all of these one after the other. And I'm always in contact with my Cuban colleagues. I spend a lot of time. It's a second nature of them to resist the United States. It's a second nature for them to defend their sovereignty. Of course, there may be differences within the population, even amongst the revolutionary forces, but there's one common feature, that we are Cuba. We are the ones who decide what has to be done in Cuba. And the outcome of this is, of course, this really great offensive that has taken place by Cuba in the course of the COVID-19 tragedy that is not only stemming the spread of COVID within their own territory, which is really an amazing feat, but at the same time, simultaneously, sending out medical brigades all over the world to make a major contribution to stemming the tide in not only in countries such as Africa and Asia, but even in Europe. You know, that great Europe, right, supposed to be so superior. But when Italy was having so much trouble, the whole European Union refused to help Italy. But who came? Who went to Italy? Cuban doctors. Of course, it made headlines, and the headlines that they made, it was good that these headlines came out, and I think this is what is probably contributing to the move across the United States, and we are doing so in Canada as well, and Europe and elsewhere, to have this petition signed to have the Cuban medical brigades being assigned as Nobel Peace Prize. That is my basic take.
Medea, we just have about 2 minutes left, and if you could, and unfortunately it's just 2 minutes, explain the political dynamics, the U.S. politics involved here, and why is it that there is this core group, particularly in Florida, of Euro-Cubans that are so opposed to freedom for the island?
Yes, well, you have this fantastic program helping people all over the world, and then you have the U.S. government trying to sabotage it, probably in large part because they're currying favor with that right-wing group in the Miami area of Cuban Americans and Venezuelan Americans for the next election. But what they are doing is trying to strong-arm countries not to accept the Cuban aid, labeling it a form of human trafficking because the doctors aren't paid their full salaries because some of the money goes to support the Cuban healthcare system, and actually paying people to find and write negative stories about this beautiful international healthcare program. So part of our effort to give to push their nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize is to counter the U.S. sabotage.
Final question, Arnold. How powerful is the United States in the Nobel system, and how big of a fight will there be by the United States to see to it that Cuba is not recognized as such? We have just about a minute.
Well, I think that the United States, of course, has its contacts all over the world, including in Canada, Europe, and various other countries, right-wing governments in Latin America, some allies in Asia. But in this particular case, unlike other cases, I really find it difficult to see how the United States could win over its allies to oppose the nomination of the Nobel Peace Prize to the Cuban Brigades, because even a country which they tried to they discouraged, they had actually had the Cuban doctors leaving Peru, okay? But since then, the right-wing Peruvian government has invited the Cuban medical brigades to come back in order to help them to fight COVID-19. So I think this is an indication that no matter how much the United States tries, I think that in the long run, they're bound to lose, but it's really up to us to make sure that this goes to the max amount of people and the max amount of countries all over the world to make sure that they win that Nobel Prize, not only for Cuba, but for, I guess you would say, the principle of international solidarity over all of the tents by the United States to squash this movement all over the world.
Arnold August, that's the voice of Arnold August. Thank you so much. Medea Benjamin, thank you as well. Look forward to having you both back on the program.
Anytime.
Wonderful. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.